This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When Michelle Tracy Berger was a young girl, her mother gave her an unusual gift, a walk-in closet. Looking back, she remembers the room as her first portal to imaginative space. Creativity was a survival tool for Michelle and her family as her family struggled to escape poverty and an abusive stepfather. Today, Michelle Berger is a creativity coach. She helps others to see creativity as a skill, not just a way to make a product. She's also a professor of women's studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Michelle Tracy Berger, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Frank. I am delighted to be here today.
It's great to have you here. Tell us about this room, this closet of yours.
So my mother, who was a creative person herself, she was a dancer early in her life and loved to paint and draw. She provided this walk-in closet, and she said, Michelle, it's all yours. You can do whatever you want in it. And I painted, Frank, and I collaged, and it was a taste of solitude. It was a taste of imagination. And I have to say, I'm going to date myself, but at the time there were reruns of Lost in Space. And not only did that whet my appetite of speculative fiction and science fiction, but I would go in that room and pretend that Will Robinson was my brother. And so it was just a place to imagine deeply different kinds of experiences. And so that was around when I was 5 to 6 years old. And that made such a deep impression on me.
It's interesting that your mother decided to give you that space. I mean, she's interested in creativity. She wants to nurture it in you so she can give you paint and clay and tell you to write whatever you want and apply your imagination in any way. But she found it. She wanted to make a point of the space, right?
She did. And I've come to think of that almost as my creativity hub or type of creativity womb, so to speak, that it was very a place to incubate ideas. And I think there was something about claiming a space. So the work that I do with clients, one of the first things I often ask them is, what kind of space do you have? Because if you don't claim the space, I find often people won't claim the time. So she was giving me that lesson at a very early age.
Did you find yourself thinking, I mean, obviously you were having different thoughts. You were having these fantasies of being sort of lost in space and other things. But as you look back now, were you thinking in different ways when you walked into that space? Did something happen to you when you walked into that closet?
Oh, definitely. I think partly it was because I could design it. So she really let me, I'm sure, against the rules. This was not a house that we owned, so it was a condominium. So I'm sure this was against the rules. But, you know, I got to paint and explore and do all sorts of things in there that just, that was special. So that was not a place where, you know, that in the rest of the house, that was not what I could do. But in that space, everything was open.
And
everything
was
possible.
You had big dreams and you were imagining even by the time you were in fifth grade, you were writing to schools, colleges and universities, telling
right.
them what you were going to do.
So I was a pretty precocious child. We'll come back to that period in my life where I made this incredible transition. But by the fifth grade, I was convinced that I was on the path to become a veterinarian. And I sat down and wrote letters to graduate schools. So to Cornell University and University of Pennsylvania, and I think I did even NC State. And I said, I would like to know what I need to do to become, you know, be considered an applicant in your graduate program. And I actually got back some responses. They were tickled and delighted and encouraged me on.
Well, that's great. When did you decide you were not going to be a vet anymore?
That came much later on. So I actually took science classes in high school and interned at the Bronx Zoo, grew up in the Bronx. And I went to Bard College, the small private liberal arts college, and started taking other kinds of classes. And actually, I was tracked to go on after Bard to go to Cornell. They have you do 2 years at a college and then you do the last 2 years at Cornell for pre-vet. And I discovered somewhere along the line that by the time you got to do really interesting work in biology, for example, it was going to be a long time. And I had discovered feminist literary theory and jurisprudence and novels and a whole range of things and political studies. So that really made my heart beat in a different way.
Started to push. Along the way, your stepfather returned to the house and the home and things became difficult for you. Tell us about that.
Yes. So my stepfather, my mother had an on and again, off again relationship with him, and she had left him once. He had kicked her in the stomach while she was pregnant with my younger sister. And so they got back together again, and he moved us from New Jersey at the time to Brooklyn. And this is something I started writing about. I'm a columnist for the Chapel Hill News. And I actually, he was abusive to my mother, but actually what made my mother leave, and this is not a story I've told publicly, was that I had come to her and said he had been sexually abusive to me. And that actually had begun by the time I was four. My mother was a telephone operator, and so she worked late at night, and she did not know that this was happening. And when we made that move to Brooklyn, he would often come in my room in the mornings to ostensibly wake me up. I was getting up very early, just waking myself up from fear. And I just thought, this was around, I was 7.5, 8 years old, I just thought that I could not go on. So I told my mother, and to her credit, Frank, she believed me. And she said to me, I'm not going to tell your stepfather. Everything's going to be fine. Later that day, my stepfather comes home. She confronts him. He, of course, denies it. And a week later, she comes into my room and says, Michelle, we're leaving in 10 minutes. Take what you can carry. And I didn't question that. I took my glasses and I took the Bionic Woman doll, which was my favorite doll, also dating myself. And she bundled up my younger sister, who was about 2, and she left my brother, which I'll come back to a little bit later. And we hustled out into the night. And one of the reasons I wanted to share that story in particular today is that it is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And I think we grow stronger by telling our stories. And so I tell people she saved my life that day.
You know that now. You know now that we grow stronger by telling our stories. You were, what did you say, 7 years old, and it had been going on for 3 years or so, or four. How difficult was it for you, and what was your thought process in those years? I mean, you didn't tell her for a long time. What was going on in your mind?
I think, like many children, I wanted everything to be okay. I think that I often say, up until that time in my life had been very idyllic. My mother's parents were still alive. I had a very strong relationship with my grandmother and grandfather. And it was just something that got sort of managed. But because, and I didn't know this word then, we know the word escalation. So by the time he moved us to Brooklyn, he also denied my mother the ability to go back to work. And things seemed to be getting worse. And it was very courageous of her to believe me without, I think the thing that really saved my life and contributed to my wholeness and goodness overall is that she believed me, and she was willing to make a change, which would alter, once we walked out into the night, that altered everything.
Was that your biggest fear? What was your biggest fear about telling your mother? Was it that she wouldn't believe you?
I think my biggest fear was just that I was not going to be able to manage my stepfather, and that it didn't seem, in the past, like I said, they were on again and off again. And at this point, we had moved to Brooklyn. He had a very solid job. He was one of the first computer programmers, doing very well at the time. And it just didn't seem like things were going to change. And my mother, I could see my mother, who, like I said, had been a dancer, went from being, you know, roughly 98 pounds, because that was just her sort of body frame, to like 130 pounds. So I could also see she was changing, and she was pretty depressed. And it just, seemed like things were not going to change.
We're going to talk about creativity in our next segment. We're coming up against that now. But I want to get ask you this first, because you talk about nurturing creativity in mm-hmm. each of us to find solutions and find ways through problems. How were you managing mm-hmm. that problem as a little girl?
Yeah, so I think the way it really revealed itself is, so once we left my stepfather, we went to Philadelphia to stay with my godparents. Actually, they were my mother's it was my mother's godmother, who's pretty elderly at the time. And I think my mother thought she was going to recreate her life there in Philadelphia. And when it was clear that that wasn't going to happen, after about a month, we ended up at the Brooklyn Department of Social Services. And this is roughly, 74, somewhere between 74 and 75. And we were lucky in that once we got to the desk, we were waiting all day. I remember this clearly. My sister, who we used to call Screaming Jay Hawkins because she was very colicky, she was quiet. And we get up to the desk, and my mother is telling the social worker, I don't have any resources. I don't want my kids to be split up. And, she was, at the time, shelters were new, shelters for battered women were pretty new, and she wasn't so excited about that. But the woman said to her, "We actually have one slot left. There's a new program at the President Hotel, and the hotel had partnered with the city to have one floor for battered women and their children." And that's when we made that move, helping my mother get through some of the next phases, was where my creativity really flourished.
We'll find out more when my conversation with Michelle Tracy Berger continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Michelle Tracy Berger, creativity coach and women's studies professor at UNC Chapel Hill. We left you at the President Hotel, which is actually a fairly nice hotel in New York, right?
When I heard that we were going to stay at a hotel, I think at that point in my life, I had, I thought, this is going to be great. This is awesome. A hotel. Great. So we trudge over there. They give us, literally, this was like at 4:30, close to 5 o'clock when the Brooklyn Department of Social Services was closing. They give us resources to get over there. And then it was a fine looking hotel. There was a doorman, Frank. It was actually pretty cool. There was a little diner connected to it. And like I said, there was this one floor that was devoted to battered women and their children. And you could stay there for up to 6 months. So we get to this hotel room. We get into the room. My mother's got me and my sister. And we open the door, and it's a very modest hotel room. There's a bathroom. There's a TV. There's no stove, no hot plate, and no refrigerator. And my mother looked around and said, "What are we going to do about food?" But we were all so tired. We just sort of collapsed in the bed like tired puppies, and we kind of huddled together. It was sort of like we had made it to the threshold. So after that, and as we're living there, and I want to say, this was it's in Times Square. I think they've remodeled it since that time in the 70s. It was an exciting time. So this was roughly November. Mm. We stayed there almost the entire 6 months. To be in downtown Manhattan, and we would run into soap opera stars and movie stars and go to shows. So there was that kind of amazing electricity in there. But my mother was worried about my brother, who she had left. She made a decision to leave him. And we knew my brother is developmentally disabled. We didn't quite know that at the time, but she knew something was, she was concerned about him. And so she was, pretty stressed out. And so that was really the time that, I say creativity can trump personal trauma, because for me, it was clear to me as the eldest child, I needed to help my mother get through this. So watching the commercials that came on with Evita, right, and the commercials of, the Broadway shows at the time, I would just start performing and singing. And when I could stay up and stay awake to see Saturday Night Live, I was doing the Steve Martin, you know, all of those impressions, right? And she just, it just gave her access to another world.
What, do you think it was entertainment to ask the musical question, is it impossible to stick a piano up your nose? For instance, Steve Martin's famous imaginative question.
Right.
Was it a distraction, do you think? Or were you creating alternate worlds at that time? What was happening to you?
Yeah, I think I was kind of pulling on those resources from that early room. So I had not before that. I don't think I'd been a very extroverted child per se, but all of that kind of came to the fore. And I would say the other way that creativity came out is that we didn't have a lot of resources. You know, my mother was on public assistance during that time period. And so, you know, when I was in school, it was the first time, because in New Jersey, I was growing up in the suburbs, I had to take the train to this, you know, to my school. I would, you know, take milk cartons and put them in my book bag and bring them. And I remember setting them up on the windowsill so they would stay cool in our room. So it was also like trying to find other resources to supplement and support us and, you know, bringing home, you know, breakfast, boxes of breakfast cereal. So it was all of those pieces, both, you know, performing and storytelling for her and keeping her spirits up, but also, you know, making up stories with my Bionic Woman doll and also doing some collaging of coloring books and things like that. So all of those pieces kind of coming together.
It sort of makes you understand that to be poor, to be struggling under those circumstances requires enormous creativity, that anybody who gets through this alive, if you have to struggle against all of those forces, is enormously creative. And yet it doesn't always bring you out of that situation. Mm-hmm. To what extent is it important to know that you're creative to allow you then maybe to find a new way of being?
Well, I think for in my experience, my mother also was very supportive of mirroring back to me that my efforts were not in vain, right? And she also was the kind of mother who was just very good at saying, you know, you're brilliant. And that's not something, I mean, that's not something often kids hear, I have to say, from their parents, right? My mother was the kind of woman that when I got my first spelling commendation, I think in the third grade, she literally leaned out. This is back in Brooklyn. We lived up three floors. She leaned out the window and said, look at my brilliant daughter. My brilliant daughter got, you know, these commendations just to passersby as well as the neighbors. So she was, you know, she also was a very powerful force in my life as well in terms of mirroring back to me that.
So tell me now about graduate school. You decide you've changed your mind already about becoming a veterinarian, but you got interested in politics. So tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I should say that. So I did political studies and creative writing as dual majors at Bard, and in many ways, I felt very torn, both in high school and then in college, about the life of the mind and the life of the arts, because I also danced and also thought about acting at one point. But I really was committed to thinking about taking marginalized knowledges, right, outsider knowledges. And this is at the time when women's studies is just really beginning to get institutionalized. And I wanted to get a PhD for various reasons. I thought I wanted to be a professor. My mentors at the time all had PhDs. And I also knew, sort of just in terms of a resource standpoint, that, you know, it was important to have the highest degree in the land. It was important for me at that time. And I was very committed to that work. And so I went, but I didn't stop writing. So I went and pursued a PhD in political science. And going from a small liberal arts school to a place like University of Michigan was a shocking transition, a powerful transition, because the kinds of questions one can ask at a liberal arts school is very different than the kinds of questions people expect in the PhD program. And so for a while, my creativity really went underground, and it took a while for me to embrace it again. And if I can, I'll tell you part of that story. So I got interested in thinking about the differences between men and women's creative cycles as I was going through this, and also thinking about how can I stay creative while doing this intellectual work. Because in the academy, we tend to, historically, we tend to think people live from the neck up, right? And there's not really places to be integrated in who you are. And I'm talking about that at a very deep personal, emotional, spiritual level, as well as a creative level. And so I was sort of searching for formats and models. And I had this dream. I'm a big follower of, a big believer in following your dreams, because the dreams are a non-rational way in to think about creativity. So I had this dream where there was this brown trunk, and the trunk opens, and literally, Frank, there's this amazing golden light that's emanating from it. And I put my hands in it, and there's just this feeling that comes over my hands. And then as I'm waking up in the from the dream, that was to me the sense that creativity is this treasure chest in all of us. And all we have to do is sort of how reach in. And then after that dream, a couple of days later, I was walking along. This is in Ann Arbor. And I found this amazing fat golden ribbon. And the underside of the ribbon looked almost like in my dream, that gold light. And so that was a place where, that was a moment where the sense of creativity is important. I didn't have all the language that I had now, but it was something that also kept me going.
You also, I mean, and in some ways, you know, you don't want to say that academic work is not creative, but
it is very creative.
It is creative, yet the form is to be objective, right? Is to take yourself, or at least it had been, outside of the study, so that you don't taint the work, and that kind of discipline is, it might be the thing that kind of drives the wedge. Do you think? I mean, is that what you're feeling? Or
I think in graduate school it was also, I don't mean creative in terms of the actual work produced, because that there's aspects of creativity obviously in all kinds of work. The actual experience of being an African American woman from an under-resourced community in graduate school at a place like Michigan, surviving that, I think, is to me where the creativity came in, right? Because there were ways in which both the things that I wanted to study were not seen as legitimate sometimes. And so I had to become very entrepreneurial. So I took courses in African and African-American studies, in sociology, in women's studies. And it was sort of the framing of that moment at that particular place at that time. And if I can give you an example, just a brief example. So roughly the first day of graduate school, sitting in this group as often happens, and people are going around saying, you know, what are you interested in? And this is, it was a big group. I came in 91, it's about 40 students, and about, I would say, 18 of us were students of color. So I'm sitting around in the room, and you know, that moment where people ask you, I was, you know, 20-something, like, what are you here to study? And I said, oh, I'm interested in African-American women's political participation. Now, that had just kind of come up. You know, I mean, I wasn't wedded to that. But I said it because, you know, you're on the spot and you have to say things. And this guy, who later became a friend, a white guy, turned to me and he said, well, you know, you can't study that because we all know that black women aren't politically active and they don't vote. And there was silence in the room and no one said anything. And I was pretty stunned, but didn't even have the wherewithal to say, hello, the civil rights movement, you know, the abolitionist movement.
SNCC was founded by whom?
Yeah. But yeah. But also it was a good moment to say that there's also ways that knowledge gets legitimated. So in his mind, and no one correct, there were faculty in the
He's in a graduate program at a place that is considered a liberal institution. So,
And a top political science program. Mm. So I often share that story with students to say there are cues sometimes that people may get about who's considered legitimate to study, what's considered legitimate to study, and to be creative is actually to question that.
And you went to sci-fi camp because, if science isn't going to provide answers here, then science fiction is really the way to go. Tell us about it.
That's right. So there's a very famous program called the Clarion Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers group, and it used to be at Michigan State. It's now at UC San Diego. But so I applied to get into the Michigan State program, and it's 6 weeks, Frank, of basically writing and reading as much as you can stand of science fiction fantasy. And they have people, they have editors come in. And I applied, I got a scholarship, I got in, and I told my dissertation chair, because this was way into my career as a budding academic. And I just said, Martha, it's something I really have to do. And she said, if you do, she said, I can't stop you from doing it. She said, you're accepted, but then you have to come back and finish your dissertation. So she's like, go experience it. And I loved it. I loved it. It was hard.
But this is not just a dalliance. I mean, it turns out that speculative fiction is something that does allow people to think critically about gender. I know you have examples of that.
Yeah, I had been reading, I would say, speculative fiction, you know, and speculative fiction, many people know this, but just as an umbrella term for fantasy, for sort of systems of magic or systems of non-rational ways of doing things. Hard science fiction, so taking science that we know now and extrapolating it and asking questions, horror, paranormal romance, it's a broad category. And so I'd been reading that for many, many years, and particularly there are a lot of people writing, Ursula Gwynn, Melissa Scott, among others, who are writing critical ways of thinking about power and gender relationships. People like Octavia Butler, who was really the first African-American woman to come to prominence writing speculative fiction. So I was interested in writing it in terms of imagining different worlds, but there is this great tradition, actually, of people asking critical questions that you, in some ways, all fiction is speculative, right? Because you're making it up. But this particular genre helps to really push those kinds of themes in ways that other genres can't.
You wrote a speculative fiction piece called Family Line, right?
I did.
Tell us what it's about, because I know you can, and would you read for us as well? Maybe you can set it up.
Oh, I would love to. Thank you so much for asking. And if I can tell a quick story of persistence. So this is for all the writers and creative folks out there. So I wrote this story. It was originally, I think, 500 words, and I sent it to a contest. And I thought, oh, this is really, I think this is going to work. And somehow they transpose Michelle Berger with Michelle Tracy Berger, and they thought I had entered twice, and they eliminated my entry. So, okay, I'm like, okay, so I go back and work on it again, and basically the story, and actually it's connected to what I did at that Clarion workshop. The story is about a young man who grows up in the Bronx. It's told in the second person, and he goes to visit his Southern cousins, who he, because he's 15 or 16 years old and he has biases, he thinks, oh, they're backwards, or they're not as cool as I am. And he, you know, does graffiti and all sorts of stuff. And so he gets quite a surprise. So I'm happy to read. So it's Nate is the main character. And he has two cousins, Corey, Little Tate, three cousins, Corey, Little Tate, and Violetta. And they're telling about this book that help them get their freedom. Yeah, he stole beasts and spells from the savage lands, from his master's library, and learned its secrets. Corey, Violetta's twin brother, interrupts, as he has been doing during your entire visit. He's a contrast to the steady mountain of Little Tate. Corey's jumpy, impatient, picking at scabs on his legs and arms when he's not running his mouth. Shut up, Corey, Violetta says. Edward was an OG, original gangster, Little Tate says, laughing. You lean back in the chair, and any lingering doubt about how stupid your cousins are vanishes. Don't they teach you anything down here? Will you believe every dumb story you hear? Nobody ever earned their freedom with a book. Nate would be afraid to see the book, Corey goads. He jumps up and leans over you. He's in your face now, and you want to slap him. He's a bully even without Little Tate's confidence. Cousin probably ain't never even been in the woods at night. That and the book make you run for the next train to New York, Corey says. Me? Scared of a book? You howl with laughter, and the pink Kool-Aid that you've been drinking snorts out your nose. Are you crazy? I tag trains in the middle of the night. What's some old book to me? At home, I've got to deal with men who'll shoot me as soon as look at me. Your cousins nod in unison, and little Tate looks satisfied as if he just scored a field goal.
That's Michelle Tracy Berger reading from a story that she wrote called Family Line, and they're referring to a book that talks about a man who had been enslaved and essentially sold his future or compromised his future for his freedom.
Yes, and so in the next part of the story, they take Nate to this old slave shack, and throughout it all, Nate thinks, oh, my cousins are putting me on. They're just trying to scare the city boy. And some very interesting things happen. And so I worked on it again. I submitted it for an anthology. And the anthology said, you know, we like it, but it's actually a little too short. And so I got the courage up. I said, hey, if I work on it one more time and make it longer, will you take it? And so I worked on it, came out to 2,000 words, and they took it.
And it, as we said, there's a lot of examples of Toni Morrison's Beloved. Certainly has a lot of paranormal elements. It's not considered speculative fiction, but it delves into the paranormal to allow us insights into these truths.
Well, and I think it's a very new moment in terms of speculative fiction, because you have many more people who are writing from traditions and myths that are not European-based. So you have a very strong African and African-Caribbean sensibility in the work, people like Nalo Hopkinson. You have Native American folks, one person in particular, Al going back, and even Sherman Alexie, who uses kind of magical realism. So there's this kind of interest in taking up questions of identity, of exile, of migration, of diaspora in these works, and also rethinking, you know, the trauma of slavery. And I think I wasn't trying to do that consciously in my work, but I was trying to think about, you know, for an enslaved person who could read. So the backstory is Edward obviously would have to read to be able to conjure up a beast, right? What are the kinds of things that people would be willing to do for their freedom?
On the State of Things, my guest, Michelle Tracy Berger, a creativity coach and a women's studies professor at UNC Chapel Hill. We'll talk more about all of that just ahead on the State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today with Michelle Tracy Berger, a creativity coach, women's studies professor at UNC Chapel Hill, a writer. And, you know, we were talking about speculative fiction and ways of looking at identity, and they're considered kind of sci-fi. Fiction is certainly part of that. When you think about any identity, the way we look at race in this country, the way any society structures identity and creates minorities, and even in grad school where you have a theoretically well-educated man who says black women don't participate, that's a truth that was so obvious to him it didn't need saying, but he said it anyway, and one we embrace without thinking. And it's a lie. All of these things are lies, but they become social order. So to call that kind of writing speculative fiction is almost, it seems to me on par with the myth of social order that we live with and never bother to question because we call it the truth.
Well, and that's why we need more people bringing different ideas into both the academy, for sure. And I like to remind people that in the academy, about 3% of the population has a PhD. And then when you think about any particular underrepresented group, I think at one point I looked this up from the Labor Department. It's like 45,000 African-American women who, not including JDs or MDs. So we're actually talking about, when we think about the academy more broadly, we need to think about bringing, you know, lots of different communities and people in who can, you know, not only tell their own stories, but research new ways of thinking and new ideas. And then in speculative fiction, it allows for ways of doing alternate history, right? Time travel. First contact stories where there are actually going to be people of color. And, you know, I mean, I think that even in the last 20 years, when we look at popular culture and science fiction, there's been much more of an attempt to show diverse societies and diverse kinds of communities. But that was not always the case. And I still remember that, as well as remembering, oh, the only black character in the film has now just gotten killed off in the first 15 minutes. Yep. So I think we're in a good place. And I also tell people that some of the most interesting work, like I said, on gender and sexuality and race and identity is really, really interesting work being done in the speculative fiction field.
You recently revisited some of your early work, and you were looking at HIV mm-hmm. And the politics that surrounded that and found a new way to talk about it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so when I came to UNC, I thought I was done thinking about HIV, and my first book had been looking at how politically marginalized women who were former sex workers and former crack cocaine users who, after becoming HIV positive, became politically active. And that broke all the modes because they didn't have what we traditionally think of as all the sort of startup capital to do grassroots organizing. So by the time I did that, I wrote my first book. By the time I came to North Carolina, I thought, I'm not going to talk about HIV anymore. And in some ways that's true, in some ways it's not true, in that over time I came to put together and work with a community organization in Durham and put together a team to not so much talk about HIV, but to figure out what's going right with African-American mother and daughter relationships, talking about health and sexuality. And when I came to North Carolina, North Carolina had one of the highest rates, actually, of HIV in the South. So I thought, okay, I want to grapple with this in some different ways. And so I put together a research community and a team to talk with African-American mothers across a wide variety of spectrums and have them tell us what they think about what they think is going right with their health and what they think is going right with their daughter's health. And so the mothers, for most of the project, the mothers would be in one room and did focus groups, and then the daughters would be in another room. And there's some just really interesting contextual historical things. So some of the mothers would tell us, you know, when I was growing up, and these were most of the mothers were raised in North Carolina, born and raised, they would say, when I was growing up, you couldn't talk about anything. It was too dangerous. Right. And there were still all of these different kinds of taboos around sexuality. And so they positioned themselves as, you know, we watch the Lifetime channel with our daughter. You know, we try to talk about these videos that they see. And then you would talk to daughters in the other room. And it was really interesting because they gave us what part of the analysis has come out is that there are definitely certain gender scripts in terms of what mothers think they're communicating around health and sexuality and what daughters hear. And unfortunately, there's still a lot of what not to do, but ideas about pleasure and the body and eroticism are still, you know, uneven. And I think mothers want more support about how to talk about that, and daughters really want knowledge.
These daughters were telling you that their mothers were not terribly open, even though mom was saying she thought she was. Was that what's happening here?
Well, it's a complicated story.
Let's simplify it, right?
Yeah, I would say that what was also interesting. So the mothers are doing everything right in terms of like health screenings and being concerned about diabetes. But one of the questions we ask are, you know, what are the things you think your daughter, you know, what's a health concern for your daughter? And the degree to HIV that HIV came up was not almost non-existent, mm-hmm. which was kind of surprising. But I think the daughters, part of the story there is that what they see, their mothers, there's a lot of mixed messages around health. And I think that also relates to class issues, to opportunity. So it's a complicated mix. But yes, the daughters, I would say, overall definitely want more information. They want kind of more scripts about what to do, perhaps in a broad context of healthy relationships than not just what not to do.
You teach a class in Women in Creativity that combines some of your political interests with the creative ones. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and I'll just give the backstory. So for years, I taught at the Friday Center. I taught a class called The 12 Secrets of Highly Creative Women. And one of the things I found out, Frank, that if you put secret in a title, people will be there. So what's great about the Friday Center is there's a lot of different adult learners. You have people, women in their 20s, all the way to women in their 70s. And so that also allowed me to deepen my interest in, you know, different ways that women think about creativity and expressions of it in their life. But at that point, after a while, I just wanted to be back in the classroom in a women's and gender studies classroom talking to women at a particular moment in their life. And so what I did is I created an academic course, and that was my gift to myself right after tenure. And so the course really asked some questions about, you know, what are the differences that we might see in terms of how women express their creativity vis-a-vis men? And mostly I deal with the contemporary period, the 20th century and forward. And what are some of the ways in which women have been silenced around creativity? And what are some of the ways in which women have reframed debates and ideas about creativity? And taking the students, what I love about this class is that not only does it give them, you know, all of this rich content, we talk about the brain, we talk about creativity as a life process, as well as a skill, but it also allows them to think about their own sense of who they are as a creative being.
Do men and women think about creativity differently?
I think when we look at particularly professional artists, we see some differences historically. We see some differences in the ability of women to gain similar accolades, similar resources compared to their male counterparts in terms of professional art, an artist. And there are lots of questions and ideas about that. And so we look at some of that material. But also I think in terms of the ways in which some women in particular have tension around this idea of being selfish versus self-focused. So we talk about external barriers. So external barriers could be you grew up where there's not a lot of role models for you in terms of the kind of creative discipline you want to go into. So going back to Octavia Butler, and the story I love to tell about, and we actually read some of her work in the class, the story I love to tell about Octavia Butler. So she's writing in the 50s, late 50s, beginning to write science fiction, not knowing there are other black people doing it, not even knowing there are other women doing it. And one of her books that came out in the late 80s, which had a black female protagonist of color, the publishing house put a white woman on the cover because they didn't think that black people read science fiction and they didn't think it would sell. So some of it is like, you know, what are the models that you have available? And then also, so those are some external barriers. And then what are the internal barriers? And so what are the internal barriers that we see are this push-pull between being, thinking of oneself as selfish for trying to claim a creative life versus what I call self-focused. Also being scared of being wrong in public. That's actually something that a lot of women tend to struggle with. And as well as the different social roles that we see women occupy. So particularly for, and I always say this when, 'cause I do a lot of work with clients who are mothers, that creativity and motherhood, there are tensions there around time, focus, and all of that.
So, wait, are there? I mean, what do women mean, or what do you mean when you say creativity? There are ways in which, you know, people are afraid that they are not creative, and that it's this thing that they either have or don't have. To what extent do you try to, or do you point out that kind of we're creative in a thousand different ways that you just never bothered to call creative? I mean, is that part of the process here, recognizing our when and how we are creative?
Well, part of it is, yeah, it's recognizing that creativity shows up as a continuum. I like to talk about it as both a product. So it's something that we can, you know, we can hold sometimes. It's a sculpture or a novel. And that's product, so to speak, and that's great. But we also want to think about creativity as the intangible, as the life process, right, as how it shows up in different ways. So how do you do a dinner party, right? How do you plan your garden, right? So we tend to default to thinking about, and this is where people get really blocked, if I'm not doing it like X, that means I'm not creative. Or I also hear often, I used to be creative before X, and it could be before my children were here, or before I had this particular job. So also thinking about how does creativity go through these ebbs and flows in one's life. And again, if I can just go back for a minute about to sort of differences between women and men's careers, women's social roles tend to change with age. So caretaking, child rearing, there's an incredible burst of creativity that can happen for some women in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. And not that it doesn't happen for men, but when we look at actually women's careers, and I like to point out people like Amy Tan, Sapphire, Toni Morrison are all people who really came forward with their creativity in their 40s as other things were shifting. And so it's not the historically for men's artistic careers, there's these bursts in the early 20s, right?
You also take a look at the question, and I know this comes up in your workshops, the question of games and interactive games and the role that they play, because parents worry about that, and the kids might argue that it's a terribly creative enterprise. Does that in any way play a part in what you do and what you talk about?
So you mean video games?
Video games, yeah.
I would say it's not any one thing that can be a detriment. I think gaming for some people can lead them into thinking about, well, I want to be a developer. I want to, make my own app, right? But it can also lead them away from, again, kind of going inside. So there is something, I think, to be said for being able to be quiet at times, being able to hear one's thoughts, being able to also, something you and I were talking about beforehand, being okay with ambiguity. That's, I think, a key way to think about, exercising one's creativity, because sometimes you don't know what you're going to create. And if you don't have experience with that, you can get really frustrated.
How much of this coaching is sort of involved, or the work you do in classes with kind of professional creativity, helping you to become a painter or a writer? Mm-hmm. And how much of it is just in sort of figuring out that by imagining yourself in new situations, you can really work out a lot of the difficulties that you think you're in? I mean, so it's life skills.
Right. And what I like to say for the people who sign up for my Women in Creativity course is that, yes, you're going to learn something about what the scholarly record and the popular record has said about women in creativity. But you're also thinking about this as a competency. And I share with them, there have been at least two studies, one in the UK and one in the US, that says one of the things that employers feel like students actually don't have graduating is creativity. And so thinking about your own role as an adaptive thinker. But I work with a range of people. I work with clients one-on-one. I work with groups, and I work in lots of different settings. I also work on creativity and leadership. And some of it, for people who are aspiring to be professional artists or want more creativity in their life, it's sort of figuring out, well, what's taking you away? Is it time? Is it ideas about time, right? Never have enough time. Is it ideas about money, scarcity of money? Is it about procrastination, perfectionism, anxiety, and then being able to give people, to have them take action?
You also launched a project called the Creativity Bonfire. Tell us about that.
Yes, this has been a labor of love over the last couple of months. The Creativity Bonfire series, it's called Sustaining Your Flame, Secrets from Wildly Inspired Creators. And it really was my foray into thinking about online learning, working with adult learners. So it's a telesummit, and I gathered together 11 other amazing artists, coaches, and visionaries to give experience and expertise on how to access creativity. So I talked to one person, Tanya Meeks, who's a performer and a therapist, and so she trains people to tell their stories without shame on stage. So both to access creativity as well as to sustain it. And so I worked with a couple of my mentors. People might know the name Sark, also known as Susan Aaron Rainbow Kennedy, who's written 16 different titles. And that was just really fantastic. And I would love to gift the listeners, if they are interested, with coming to the site. It's called creativitybonfire.com, and they could have access to 12 amazing calls.
Michelle, what a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Michelle Tracy Berger is a creativity coach and a professor of women's studies at UNC Chapel Hill. If you didn't get that website, check out ours, stateofthings.org, and we will have a link to it and many other things that we talk about here on The State of Things, a program produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Mataferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf, the news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.